This is an ABC podcast.
If you talk to my wife, Maria, she certainly dined out on the reality that there were boxes and boxes of cockroaches in our bathtub, which was the food source for whatever we were holding at the time.
Hello, I'm Ann Jones, and this is Off Track, and coming up on ABC Television is Australia Remastered. This is a series where producers have combed through the ABC archives to find a heap of footage of Australia's unique fauna, and they've edited it all together to take you on a journey all around Australia to meet gorgeous creatures who we don't get to see on our daily walks, to be fair. I thought that this was an excellent excuse to get just a couple of people that were involved behind the scenes in the past on to talk to them about the lengths that they went to in order to get the shot.
I went up to the Murchison Ranges to collect the Peppermound Mouse, which is then taken back to Melbourne to be filmed. Mike was telling me that he collected the rocks that were in that scene from the Devil's Marbles. The beauty is that even though it's not done a la naturel, it still teaches the rest of the population about these sorts of things. And I think my personal perception is that if you're looking after these animals properly, then that helps us to help them survive.
And why not start with probably the biggest series that the ABC ever attempted in the natural history genre, The Nature of Australia, which aired in 1988.
Well, we hadn't made programs like that before.
Dione Gilmore is a doyen of natural history television production in Australia, and she was one of the producers on that series.
We've made much shorter in terms of development of them, much shorter television programs. You know, we'd go to a place and we'd make series of half hours quite quickly. I mean, you're talking about the day when we're working in film and not working on tape. The technology changes what you're doing and how you're doing it. I mean, we've filmed animals that have since gone extinct. We recorded behaviour of animals, and behaviour of animals is something that takes a long, long time.
What sort of lengths did the filmmakers go to get the shots that were in this film?
It sounds idiotic when you say it today, but for instance, I think David Pera, who got The Birth of the Roo, which hadn't been done before, I think he tried it seven times before he actually got the material that he wanted. So that means packing up, going bush, spending time watching, getting used to the animals, seeing what they're doing, and then trying to get the various pieces of behaviour, but then not getting them and coming home and trying again. Yeah. I sent a guy up to the top end because I was very enthusiastic to get these. Do you know these big rolling clouds they get at the top end?
Yeah.
And they only get it at certain times of the year, and they roll. It's this big rolling cloud. It rolls for miles. And I sent a guy up there to get rolling clouds, and he spent something like 8 weeks trying to film clouds.
How much, though, of the shooting actually happened on sets that were constructed to make sure that you could get those beautiful close-up shots of, you know, animal faces and tiny little movements?
We did quite a bit of filming in sets because there's just no way you could do it out in the field. Because the other problem is, how do you keep your Australian animals in captivity happily? You know, and that's obviously our very first thing, is not to damage the animals or annoy or upset them in any way whatsoever. So, for instance, I had sugar gliders. I kept it in my wardrobe in my bedroom for a while. We had a platypus that I had to go and feed every day. You know, some animals we kept because it would have been difficult to get the details. But now you've got better technology for recording images, and I think you could do a lot more of it without having anything in captivity, or very little.
And it wasn't just the ABC staff members with gliders in their closets. There were consultants and local experts all over the country who worked behind the scenes to make this film happen. Mike Gillam is a naturalist, an author, and a stills photographer, and he was employed as a sort of wrangler and a fixer behind the scenes in Alice Springs for The Nature of Australia, and also for crews from other broadcasters internationally, actually. He's got a lot of stories.
I have good memories of burrowing frogs. You needed that time to wait until it rained, go out, catch the cyclorhinas when they're active on the surface trying to breed, take them home, create these sets, well, essentially great big containers with the same soil from the site where they were, let them burrow into the ground, hold them for 6 to 8 months, and then the film crew would come back. We would apply rainwater in studio. You could not film this behaviour in the wild. It's just not possible. You'd need 10 lifetimes to do this sort of stuff. We'd set up camera and lights and apply rainwater, and these frogs would appear out of the mud. They would claw at the outer layer of skin, which is essentially a mucus that they've secreted to create almost a plastic bag effect to reduce water loss while they're underground. They would drag this outer layer off and eat it all on camera. Then, of course, I would bring those frogs back to condition and feed them and have to hold them for months until it rained again and take them back to their particular clay pan and release them, usually fatter and healthier than when I got them. But, you know, it required enormous lead times to film that sort of behaviour.
Dr. Anne Curley is an ecologist, a consultant, who, in the 1980s, was living in Alice Springs and juggling all sorts of consulting work, along with being a new mum. And when the Nature of Australia filming came up, she started work juggling some even more bouncing babies, bilbies.
It's a burrowing nocturnal marsupial, which feeds on invertebrates that they dig up out of the ground. And understanding how they survived and where they lived was something that we didn't know at the time.
And the bilbies weren't the only ones. We were still trying to learn the basics about another little bouncer, the marla.
It's a funny little animal. It's very, I can't remember a full description of its height, but it's probably only 30 centimetres tall. It's gingery coloured with quite untidy fur. You know how you look at a kangaroo and its fur's nice and sleek and lying down on its back? The marla's fur stands up, so it looks woolly. And when it runs, this always cracks me up completely, when it runs, it sticks its little front paws out sideways. So a kangaroo will hop along with its front paws neatly tucked up and down, and this little guy belts along. He doesn't do anything by halves, rushing between Spinifex clumps with his arms straight out. Races up and down, and that's what he used to do in my hallway, race up and down. But really beautiful little animals, just stunning and totally, totally unique in so many ways.
Side note, ASRI is the Arid Zone Research Institute. They had an office and a heap of researchers in Alice.
Remembering how early we're talking about, 1986, pivotal time really in understanding anything about these animals. We knew they'd really dropped in numbers all over the place. The ASRI team were working very closely with Aboriginal people right across the Tanami and further south and further east, just to learn what was there, what wasn't there now, taking the old men out and trying to understand all that sort of information. And in many ways, that's only a start, because you need to remember that bilbies were right across to the Goulburn area, by the way, in their earliest stages before we wiped them out. So you're looking initially at a desert animal, thinking it's a desert animal, when in fact it was a very widespread animal. So pivotal times in understanding anything about these animals, I think, is probably how I'd put it.
Anne says at the time, ASRI had animals in captivity that they were using for research, trying to figure out some of the things we take for granted now, what these animals ate, what their habits were and all of that. And it meant that in this case, the animals didn't have to be removed from their original habitat for the filming. Rather, Anne had to build them a habitat.
But looking through my diary, it's the main thing that sort of I've written in my diary, because I managed the construction of the cages at the Arid Zone Research Institute, hired somebody to collect and dump tons of sand and dig holes for the cameraman and all that sort of stuff that has to go into making a set for filming these things. It was built beside the... Funnily enough, I actually have a diagram of it in my diary, which I managed to find with some difficulty last night. It was actually built beside the Marley Yard. I think the bilbies were mostly kept indoors. You've got to remember that at this time too, a lot of these things happened in a let's work out what's needed scenario. So in terms of what the research was doing, was it actually finding out what these animals needed to survive on. So I think predominantly the bilbies were kept inside and the marla were kept in an outside yard. And so the set was actually built adjacent to the marla yard. And because the research that had been done in the field up in the Tanami indicated that the marla were coming out and grazing, and the bilby both, were coming out and grazing on burnt areas, recently burnt areas, as they were starting to reshoot, there was a sort of a recreation of a burnt habitat. And then it had trees and, you know, vegetation put in at the back, particularly Spinifex. So we had to rebuild that whole set. And the set was built with sort of specified filming requirements. So it had a pit right beside the fence into the marla yard, which the camera people sat in. And then it was sloped upwards from the filming point towards through the so-called burnt habitat and into the vegetated area. So it was fairly specific in the way it was constructed to accommodate probably both what the filming requirements were and also what we knew of their habitat requirements. This is still fairly early on in the research for both these species, by the way. When there's funding to do these sorts of things, it's important that even though it's not done a la naturale, it still teaches the rest of the population about these sorts of things. It teaches the people who are researching about these sorts of things. And the amount of effort is really huge. I'm just trying to find, I had a list of things I had to go and buy, and one of them was a 20 amp cable just for the filming to be done. A lot of power required. Two power points needed to take two 20 amp leads. Pit to film from, set to be sloped, animals to be accustomed to lights. Actually, that's why I stayed up watching them, because the animals were acclimatised first. There's pictures of me sitting at night, all wrapped up because it was in June, or was it July, changeover. It was freezing cold. So I'm sitting in a chair, rugged up to the nines, watching the animals. So, you know, that's the sort of stuff that goes behind these things in order to make it happen at all. I guess my feeling is that it's actually good to have, even though it doesn't appear to be a set, well, you hope it doesn't, it's still informative.
And the opportunity to spend so much time observing and filming the animals led to observations of previously unseen behaviours.
Yeah, spraying of pheromones is something that I think we picked up for the first time from the marla during the filming while they were in the set, so that it's actually on film somewhere, we think. Cats do it too. It's called sprainting, where they spray out pheromones from down below. And it's part of their marking process. They mark their territories. They mark their females, probably. I don't know. But it's territorial behaviour. It's mating behaviour that they spray out these pheromones to establish who they are in the world, essentially, I guess. A lot of animals do it. Whether we know they do it, probably we don't know. But this was actually filmed, in my recollection, during this work, and it was suspected probably, but hadn't actually been fully recorded in this way, and it's recorded on film and happened because we were sitting there watching them. Nature of Australia was pivotal in bringing a whole lot of these things into the living room of Australia and probably overseas too, and for that it deserves an enormous amount of credit. And when you think about what they tried to cover in those six episodes. It was huge. It was unutterably huge.
Anne says she didn't even have a TV in the 1980s when she was working on this. And I suppose you don't even need it when you live right there in amongst the best wild things in the world. Mike Gillam.
I have the luxury of living here, Anne. I have the luxury of living here. So I'm hardwired to these episodic moments, you know. Every species has its moment to dance. And I'll rush out bush if there's, you know, the right rain for a particular frog. It's a luxury when you live here, but pretty tough bringing all this expertise from the rest of Australia into Alice Springs, for instance. Dencie Klein and Jim Frazier, I can't speak highly enough about that team. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with Dencie's writing. Jim Frazier was a great technician. They worked tirelessly on ants. And to do that is, once again, incredibly difficult in the wild. So they created a plaster nest based on excavations of Molophorus bagoti, little, I guess we call them, what do we call them here? Fire ant, whatever. They're a bright orange ant that charges around the country when it's impossibly hot. So it's a classic piece of resource petitioning. Everyone else has given up and gone back to their burrows, and this Molophorus just tears around at great speed when it's in the 40s. So they excavated a burrow, they collected worker ants, they collected soldier ants, they collected repletes, essentially a modified worker ant that stores honey as a wonderful way of attenuating the booms and busts of a desert climate. They have a storage ant which holds honeydew collected from various plants when it's abundant, and stored in the worker ants for when things are a lot tougher. So they collected all those ant casts. They made a plaster nest based on their observations in the wild. The ants, of course, were very happy to inhabit the nest and be fed, and they filmed that with fibre optics and ants running around tunnels and chambers. Beautiful work, but, you know, weeks of work. I guess it was a combination of filming in the wild and filming in set. Unfortunately, the realities of film is that it is just cost prohibitive to sit out in the Mulga week after week waiting for something to happen, you know. Look, I remember with Wedgetail Eagles, for instance, David Pearer was the cameraman, and he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Well, look, we need to find a carcass, essentially. And I advise you go and talk to Parks and Wildlife, because there's a few areas where donkeys are a real problem. And maybe you'll get one of the rangers to shoot a donkey, which they're going to do anyway. And we'll cart the donkey to a particular site and set it up. And I know a place where one of those big Intermont valleys where wedge-tailed eagles are always overhead, you know, a kilometre or two up." And I'll organise it. So, you know, I took a backhoe out and I dug a deep trench, a couple of metres deep, and put a great big timber lid on it and propped it up so that we were filming at ground level. And we were 13 metres from the carcass ant. So I can't tell you how exciting it is to listen to the displacement of air as eagles land at a carcass from 13 metres away. It's just, you know, it's, yeah, a sound that you'll never forget. And then we would crawl into that hole at 4:30 in the morning before the sun was up and get ourselves organised. And at first light, once those wedgetails had enough sun on their backs, they would get up and ride the thermals for a little while and come down and behave and argue and interact around the carcass. So I think, you know, probably that was 5 days on that one carcass. And you know, brilliant results from that. But yeah, look, reptiles and frogs are particularly difficult. Birds are a lot easier. You know, reptiles are by their nature small, cryptic, hard to find. So we did quite a bit of work on set. I'm thinking now of Jan Olderhoven and Glenn Carruthers, filmmakers who worked on Kangaroos, Faces in the Mob, very well-loved series. I remember them filming Diplodactylus conspiculatus, a tiny little gecko with a broad carrot-shaped tail. So a bit like a blunt carrot. We were working to, you know, pretty ambitious scripts. You know, when I think back, insanely ambitious scripts. And essentially, this little gecko takes over spider holes, usually large wolf spider holes, runs around at night doing its thing, and during the daytime hangs upside down in the spider hole, blocking the entrance of the tunnel with its tail. Now, you know, it's such a great thermoregulating advantage to be able to maintain your active body temperature if you're an ectotherm, block the entrance of the tunnel, beautifully camouflage with a tail so that predators can't find you. You're living in a nice, humid microclimate. If it gets too hot, you can go down the tunnel, and essentially late afternoon you can come back up and bring your body temperature back up, and as soon as it's dark, run around and do your thing on the surface. So, you know, Jan and Glenn spent days filming that, and I, from memory, they constructed, you know, plaster casts and artificial burrows, which the geckos were very happy to move into and take over. But I'm just, to film that in the wild would be tough. Yeah. I mean, we were holding thorny devils, for instance, you know, magnificent little agamids that live on these tiny black ants, little iridomyrmics. And so we were holding them, and we would rush out and we'd feed them for endless hours on an ant nest and bring them home, and they were filmed out bush, obviously. Now, I'd put them on ant trails here, and these things were eating several thousand that are sitting. You know, they certainly worked wonders for dealing with some of the pesty iridomyrmics on our block. Yeah, we'd take them on long drives and spend hours watching them and looking after them and babysitting them and then bring them back. It's, look, to do this stuff ethically is incredibly exhausting.
There were so many more people who were incredibly important to this production and to natural history the world over. And I've just had a chat with a couple for this program to whet your appetite, basically, for Australia Remastered Wild Australians. It screens on ABC TV from this Sunday, August the 30th. The whole six parts of Wild Australians will be available on iView straight away from Sunday. So you can binge every single one of them. Well, right after you finish listening to this. Remember earlier in the year when we talked with Dr. Eleanor Velasquez about the immense pumice rafts that appear in the ocean, spewed out by deep volcanoes and going on to become transport mechanisms for tiny little organisms to travel from one side of the world to the other? Well, the latest large pumice raft has started to arrive in northeast Australia, and Eleanor wants those samples. So if you're on a beach and you see a holy, bubbly sort of rock with all sorts of sea creatures on it, please grab that rock and get in touch with Eleanor Velasquez. She'll organise to have the pumice collected from you for her studies. I'm Ann Jones, and this is Off Track, the only permanent natural history program on the ABC at the moment. So make sure you subscribe and get in touch. And above all, remember to meet me here because next time I'll take you somewhere else.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.